Bitcoin is anti-fragile. It secures $2 trillion worth of value currently. And there's a huge monetary incentive to maintain that security. And there's a number of very intelligent people who are working on that problem of just making sure that Bitcoin is quantum resistant. There might be a period of time where there's a transitionary period that could be quite, stressful. But once that's done, then we've hardened Bitcoin, for the foreseeable future.
What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. We've got a chat episode today. We've got a conversation sitting down with Hunter Beast. And the intention was mostly just to talk about quantum stuff because they have put together BIP 360 basically as a framing for how to think about, and so that we basically have a plan. So there is a plan in place if the quantum problem ever becomes a problem. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable perspective to have on it, is that, well, we shouldn't have nothing because there is some sort of a risk and we don't know the timeline, et cetera, et cetera. And we get into kind of all of that and weighing the risks versus how big of an issue is this? Should we be worried about it? And then we also kind of get into the nitty gritty of what those trade-offs and what the methods of upgrading and things like what our options even are, what quantum computing even is, multi-dimensions, angels and demons, and of course, why wouldn't you round it out with aliens? So this is going to be a good one. And a shout out real quick to Fold for sponsoring the show, for being huge supporters and being just a fantastic way to stack sats. Fold is literally my banking and it is the way to stack. If you have a traditional, crappy, normal fiat bank, if you literally just switch this over to Fold and earn sats on everything that you do, the amount of rewards that you can get and Bitcoin that you can save that you can literally withdraw anytime into your self-custody, you should really consider it if you haven't. And you can get 20,000 sats using my referral code. Link will be right there in the show notes. But then you should also check out the BitKit wallet. There are very few apps and wallets that have a combined self-custodial, on-chain, and Lightning interface. And especially one that actually makes it really simple, intuitive, and just like a really clean UI. BitKit has that. BitKit is fantastic with that. Their design is phenomenal. But in addition, they also have little live widgets for just like news items and the Bitcoin price. That's actually one of the ones that I use. I find myself opening it just to check the Bitcoin price on my little widget. But it's a great wallet for everyday use on mobile. And if you haven't checked it out, you definitely should. And you know what? I'll have my public key in the show notes so you can add me. Add me as a contact. But with that, let's get into today's conversation with Hunter Beast, talking all about quantum computing and how to think about the risk and how to prepare for the inevitable one day in which all cryptography has a shelf life and we should expect that it will be broken. And what's the framework for having Bitcoin survive that next 100 years? And then, of course, when you go down the quantum rabbit hole, you inevitably have to talk about angels, demons, and aliens. So buckle up. This is Aliens, Demons, and Quantum Cryptography with Hunter Beast. All right. Welcome back. Let's get into this. Hunter Beast, welcome to the show. This is a topic. We'll have a bunch of things to talk about, but in particular, quantum stuff is something that is probably one of the most frustrating topics to me. I think a lot of people talk about it who don't know what they're talking about, both sides, like all over the place. Like people have no idea one way or the other, but they're certain it's the end of the world and they're certain it's nothing. So,
yeah. It's a lot of very strong opinions on it.
Yeah. So let's start with introduce yourself. You basically a lot of this will be about, you know, the bit that you wrote about quantum cryptography. And I am curious, your, just like we just mentioned, is that your background, you know, what kind of led you to the whole quantum thing? Why are you interested in Bitcoin in relation to that, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah. So I started out like kind of on the ETH side in 2017, because I live in Denver, and it's just kind of like the thing here, at least it was during the time. And in 2021, I did myself the favor of reading the Bitcoin Standard, and
that'll do it.
That'll do it. Yeah. Like if you like read it with an open mind and you're just like intellectually honest with yourself, like, well, you know, it's like a primer, you know, like gets you up to speed with that rabbit hole. And so I found it very valuable. And, after that, it was like, I realized I needed to dedicate myself to, making Bitcoin a thing, you know, like I felt, it's one of the biggest problems that we could ever spend our time solving on. And we have a limited time on this earth. And, so if I'm, you know, I could be working on, like, I've worked for Silicon Valley for much of my tech career, worked on databases and things like that. And, it's funny, like when I first saw Bitcoin, like maybe 2013 or so, like I first heard about it, like I just thought it was like this incredibly inefficient database, because I had a background in databases. And so I just thought
it kind of is, like, though.
Yeah, it is. So I wasn't wrong, but I also was like a bit of a socialist at the time. So I just didn't understand what money was.
Yeah.
Like a lot of socialists don't understand the value of money, like what role it plays in society, you know, like solving what Lynn Alden calls the coincidence of wants, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that I focused on early on was the RGB project. I found that to be super inspiring, just because their ambition is to add smart contracts to Bitcoin without needing to make any changes to it at layer one. And it basically just puts a smart contract on a UTXO, and wherever you spend that UTXO, it updates the contract. And so it's all off-chain and peer-to-peer, and like your wallet is basically doing the accounting work that is normally being done by, say, EVM or something. And so I thought that was like really clever design when I understood it. And so I spent a good amount of time working with Dr. Orlovsky and people associated with him. And that was a lot of fun. Have you interviewed Dr. Orlovsky, by the way?
No, I don't believe I have.
He is an amazing guy. You definitely should like consider. Yeah, he's
I'll put great. That on my list.
Yeah, no, he's great. And then I spent about 2.5 years of my life trying to make RGB a reality, and it took a little too long to finalize the protocol, so I overshot my runway on that. So I had to go looking for honest work, and I wound up working for Mara.
The miners?
Yeah.
Oh, sweet. Okay.
Yeah. So they have a team called Mara Tech, and we're working on Andro, which is a sidechain project.
I don't know about this.
Yeah. So it's like another side chain. It's supposed to be like kind of multi-chain. It has a like an EVM chain that has Bitcoin as its unit of account, and then it has kind of like a forked Bitcoin core similar to Liquid that has a whole bunch of other features. And we're deciding what to put on it. But one of the things we're considering building into it is qubit support, which we can go into.
Oh, so you can basically prep the environment for that software or that signature type and stuff moving forward. Is it basically a federated thing?
Yeah.
What's the bridge?
Yeah. It is a federated bridge. We're working on getting a diverse set of members to run the nodes. And mm-hmm. what I'm working on right now actually is a technology called HSM. So it's a hardware security module. And basically, it's like this box where you can tell it, generate some private keys for me. And whenever I want you to sign for one of these keys, please like sign like maybe for a public key, you know, and it'll keep the keys like kind of internal, like hermetic to the box, and it'll try to like keep these as secure as possible. This is like military grade security, and so hopefully we're building with the best and that sort of thing.
Dude, the democratization, I guess is the word, just the accessibility and how things have changed in the HSM market, like because of Bitcoin, because of, I mean, really the whole crypto environment, but just because of the way things are going is so crazy to me. And it's so bizarre that it has become like a consumer product. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like secure element type stuff. Yeah. I'm a big fan of the Foundation Passport. I have one.
That's a good one. I love a lot of hardware wallets, man. I literally got my Cold Card cup.
Oh, nice. yeah, good stuff. Yeah, I played with Cold Card a little bit, but the calculator form factor to me isn't as useful as the almost like a Nokia phone, you know. It's like it has like a pad for, oh, it's great. And also the camera and like QR scanning is just so good.
I love that. My I haven't gotten to play much with, because I've just been using my old Cold Cards. I haven't gotten to play with the Cold Card Q much, but the best ones for the screen, or the ones that I have that I really like for the screen, are Keystone, Foundation, Cold Card Q. And do I have another one? I really want one of the Spectre ones. I really want one of the Spectre like DIY ones, but I've never actually finally gone and gotten that kit and actually had time to work on it. But
yeah, Foundation has a new one actually that has like a bigger screen. Have you seen that one?
Really? No.
Yeah, it just came out like in middle of December. One. Yeah, middle of December it came out. The only problem I have with it is it's got Bluetooth on it, and I mean, some people that's a plus, that's a minus. Yeah,
yeah. I'm a Bluetooth deactivator.
Yeah, yeah. I slipped mine into a Faraday cage sleeve. You know, abundance of caution there.
Well, sweet. I want to know about qubits.
Yeah, so what we call qubit is with a capital B. It's the name of the soft fork that we intend to push forward. And by we, I mean like my peers at Surmont Systems, which is a Bitcoin initiative for quantum security. And we've just been working for the past half year on architecting and designing how, you know, we might add quantum cryptography, post-quantum cryptography to Bitcoin in a practical and like, how would you say?
With the lowest barrier, like the lowest disruption in how things work.
The whole reason we want to have this is so that we have an actual plan for what they call Q day, right? Like when we start to realize over time, it might take us a little bit of time to realize that Bitcoin has been compromised from a quantum computer perspective, what they call a cryptoanalytically relevant quantum computer. So once that's available, if that's available, if it ever works, you know, we want to just be able to have a plan we can set in action that's concrete and we're not starting from zero, from scratch, right? From like, we're not scrambling, right? Mm-hmm. Like, ideally, we engage with the community, we engage with all the stakeholders, and we make sure that everybody's happy with the direction, at least, you know, happy enough, right? So like, mm-hmm. There's always like, it's all about compromises, obviously, because like, Bitcoin is just one thing. And then there's like, you know, all the people who use it and need it and that sort of thing. And we obviously don't want to break Bitcoin. We don't want to like introduce any kind of major attack vectors. Mm-hmm. And when you're dealing with post-quantum cryptography, one of the challenges is the signature verification time. And so if we make like, there's all these like things we need to balance. For example, if it takes 10 to 100 times longer to validate a post-quantum signature versus like Schnorr or ACDSA, right? Mm-hmm. Then that is not only a potential attack vector, but it's also an argument to not increase the witness or not increase a discount to those bytes, to the signature mm-hmm. bytes. So that's complicated, but then if you don't increase the discount, then you dramatically lower Bitcoin's throughput, especially for these high value transactions that you might want to secure with at least two or three different post-quantum cryptography algorithms. So mm-hmm. there's so many factors to balance. And I did a deep dive into, you know, what a post-quantum cryptography supporting transaction would look like and how many bytes it would take up. And I then modeled, you know, potential increases in discounts for the signature data alone. Mm-hmm. And that resulted in about like maybe at most 1,000 transactions per block. Okay. And that's only using one PQC algorithm. And that's also assuming that each transaction is only one signature for one input. So basically like 1,000 inputs signed into a block would be the most we could support with SegWit. Mm-hmm. If we were to store the signatures in a separate portion of the transaction, we define as an attestation in the BIP 360.
Basically do what SegWit did the first time.
Do it again over, yeah, except with a substantially limited rule set. So, like
benefit would be that old nodes wouldn't really have to care about the signatures,
right? And also, that is like the primary thinking behind that actually was that we didn't want to give a discount to anything that wasn't a signature, a valid signature, public key.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And so we wanted to like, take out the script requirement, basically encode the public keys and signatures directly as fields within like a data structure that's very similar to how the witness is encoded in the transaction.
Okay.
It's just script can't go in there. It's like just very...
Okay, so it basically doesn't allow you to... Like it still just has to be a valid signature for it to be valid. And so you can't just like stick a whole bunch of JPEG in it. It has to be a signature relationship to the information in the transaction.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And that's why we call that the attestation, to distinguish mm-hmm. it from the witness. And it allows us to play with, at least conceptually, with a larger discount for PQC signatures.
Mm-hmm.
And so I modeled 16x and 64x discounts versus like, you know, the 4x discount that we currently have with SegWit.
Mm-hmm.
And the discount only gets you so much. Like there's like kind of like a transaction weight limit. Like you could set it to 100 and it still would, you know, only get us like maybe 5,000-6,000 transactions per block. And that's because like we're discounting bytes, but we're not like increasing the 1,000, you know, like, or 1 million, I should say, like V byte.
The actual byte of transaction information, of data. Yeah.
Right. Well, not the actual bytes, but like what it weighs into.
Okay. I see.
So like, technically like the weight, like it's calculated by weight units. And so there's like 4 million weight units that can go into a block. And some bytes count for more, some bytes count for less. Like things in bytes in the script hub key aren't discounted, but things, bytes that go into the witness are discounted. So basically meaning that they count for one in the witness, but four in the script hub key.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so if we were to then discount like this again, we would say instead of 4 million, it would be like 16 million. Mm-hmm. And each byte in the witness would be, you know, worth four. And each byte in the script hub key would be worth 16. But
and then transaction data would be one.
One, exactly. Attestation data, exactly. Yeah. And so, and if we did that, we'd get maybe 3,000 transactions per block and at like a maximum.
Which is about where we are. It makes sense that it would be roughly aligned. You get like 3,500, maybe 4,000 on a good day.
Right, exactly. I thought it was like a good balance between, you know, just keeping the witness discount and going like full hog 64, 128x discount, right? That's essentially like the plan I would have for like the increased size of post-quantum cryptography, because the signatures and the keys are much larger, generally speaking. And they also take much longer to validate. And so there's another consideration is like if we do increase the discount, then we, at least for those bytes, then we're discounting bytes that take longer to verify. And so we would then need to look into maybe acceleration. So one thing that I'm going to have some resources for is basically building a post-quantum cryptography library for Bitcoin, and what signature algorithms we support are still up in the air. They're like we've outlined a few in the BIP, but I'm starting to think that we should take that out, because some of the signature algorithms I specified, like one of them, for example, has this verification time that's like 100,000 times longer than ECDSA.
Whoa.
Yeah. But the benefit of it was that it would result in signatures about 300 bytes long, which is like,
oh
yeah, it's a huge improvement.
There's a huge shift in storage versus
like thousands of bytes. Yeah. Thousands of bytes.
Wow. But
like
that's
the trade-off is computational complexity. Yeah. And so
you're like running an AI model to get that.
Yeah. Well, so like what we were considering was like having GPU acceleration for signature verification. Having like GPU accelerated post-quantum cryptography could be like the future. Of course, then you would need like an embedded GPU along with your CPU in any kind of node that might be validating these transactions. So there's a lot of SBCs out there, small single board computers that are like like Raspberry Pi that do include a GPU in the SoC. And so making use of that, or SIMD even, could be like decent ways to accelerate signature verification in a way that plebs can still run their own nodes and validate every signature and that sort of thing. The other consideration, of course, with increasing the discount is like how many bytes actually go out into each block. And so if I recall correctly, the actually, let me just double check my math. I wrote an article on this. It's on X articles under my profile. It's called P2QRH qubit/qubit chain growth rate calculations. And
send me that link.
Yeah, sure. Qubit 16, what I called it, qubit 16 is 10 megabyte blocks, 3,000 transactions per block, 500 gigabyte chain growth per year. And that's okay. Like worst case scenario, like or maybe not worst case scenario. It's, in many ways, it's like...
That's if it's being totally utilized.
Where like people are securing their transactions with post-quantum cryptography. Mm-hmm. So like in many ways, like that's a good thing, but also... like it's not always going to be necessary either. For example, you could, like set a very high fee rate for your transaction and then, use classical cryptography to secure it and then, maybe take it privately to a miner optionally and, have them mine that for you. Kind of like a Slipstream, if you heard of that for Mara. That way you're not revealing your public key to the broader mempool. And then when that gets mined, you can actually mine your transactions pretty inexpensively. So basically supporting classical cryptography still, so long as like there's not a lot of like chain reorg activity and that sort of thing, then you should be relatively safe with smaller amounts. But like there's all this like...
I tend to immediately be afraid of the idea of out-of-band mining, but yeah, it's an interesting idea.
Well, like that's essentially what qubit is supposed to correct, right? Like that, like we can trust the mempool again. Even if you do reveal your public keys to the mempool, they can't be...
Oh, you mean, I guess, specifically in the context of if it comes at risk, it becomes a... Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And so, like, you'd essentially, like, need to trust, like, a miner not to reveal your public keys to like, you know, people outside of the mining pool, essentially, or people who are... Like ideally they trust everybody getting the block template, there's just so many, like, it's such a complex problem, and we've thought through, you know, like we try to put like a good amount of that thought into the BIP, like to encapsulate, because it is the first post quantum cryptography BIP out there that is like submitted to the BIPs repo and gone through review. It's been over 6 months that we've been going through like the discussion on the mailing list and discussions delving Bitcoin and additionally like just review on the PR into BIPs. And so fortunately we did finally get our BIP number, BIP 360. So it's a good, nice little even number, easy to remember. And also, like, oftentimes the representation of a qubit, like the fundamental unit of quantum computing, is like is a circle. And so they have like like different probabilities of collapsing into a one or a zero. And there's also like kind of like a rotation vector, it's pretty like complicated stuff that I've dived a little bit into that too. I've read a couple books on quantum computing, but the thing about quantum computing is that it's been theoretical for, you know, ever since I think it was Richard Feynman, he came up with that in like the 80s, and then in the 90s, a guy named Peter Shor just like kind of put the pieces together, and he came up with an algorithm that could potentially derive a private key from a public key and just basically break elliptic curve cryptography. And they knew that could be a possibility as soon as like 1995 and or so. And so like this was kind of like known within cryptography circles even back then. There's always the possibility that Satoshi knew about that and kept that as a consideration in how he designed, you know, the original Bitcoin clients that were mining to pay to public key addresses. Because the early block rewards were defaulting to just public keys. And Satoshi said that, you know, like you're supposed to mine to different public keys, or at least use different public keys for every transaction, mm-hmm. so that you have better privacy. But an additional like consideration is that if you mine to separate public keys, then a quantum computer can't just like get this giant honeypot, right?
Can't just like get one key and then wipe you of everything. You have to do every single key one at a time, and you have to do it over and over again. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And there's about 34,000 pay to public key addresses out there that contain about almost 2 million Bitcoin. And that's about like a 50 Bitcoin on average each.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting to think about it just in the context of, regardless of when it becomes a thing, is that mining will come back. There will literally be like shipwreck sort of like gold recovery with Bitcoin potentially in trying to brute force these public keys potentially in a world where we actually have some sort of at least semi-general quantum type of computation. Now, since we have kind of a general picture of how one might add quantum signatures and stuff to Bitcoin, and we kind of have the SegWit past soft fork as kind of a framework for how we might do that and lay out the discount and, you know, that sort of thing, how we would treat it. Or just kind of like do your best on laying out your perspective as to how big of a concern this is, why you think it's a concern on whatever time frame you think it's a concern on. Like, I mean, on 50 years, I think, yeah, absolutely. But I am constantly back and forth as to whether the next decade is anything to even like think about. I certainly appreciate, I much rather have BIP 360, you know, like I would much rather just have it. And I totally like, you know, this needs to be nuclear grade software. Like if there is some sort of an attack vector, we need to at least have something laid out. And that's really cool. And that's also why I like having you on this show, is because I think that's no matter what the time frame is, I think starting that conversation is not a bad thing at all.
Right. And that's what we want to do, is just start the conversation and have something we can like kind of rally around and discuss like from an actual practical implementation level perspective, like how we might do this. And so
what are the details, you know?
Right, exactly, because there's a lot of details we have to think through.
Yeah, I mean, we can always be like, oh yeah, we'll just remodel the basement when we get to that, but it's like, okay, where are the rooms gonna go, where's the bathroom gonna go? It's like, do we have a plan for the basement if when we get there, you know? Like,
yeah, so, and yeah. There's so many considerations. Mm-hmm. But
actually, I'll give you an easy place to start. Well, I mean, you may not even have any like concrete details on it, but I'll give you a place to target that I've been thinking about recently. Is, did you ever find, because I have like a hell of a time, and I'll spend like an hour or two every single time I find like, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to figure out, you know, what this is. I'm going to get into the nit and gritty of this. And I cannot find it almost universally. And it is so frustrating to me what exactly the computation was on this most recent, I think it was it Google or whatever? The most recent, like the new
Willow.
Thank you. Do you know what the computation was, and what degree of relationship and virtual qubits and, you know, all of that stuff. What's your general overview of the status of Willow and its relationship to this problem?
Yeah. So like one of the major problems that quantum computers have is their susceptibility to noise.
Mm-hmm.
And that results in decoherence of the circuit, the quantum circuit, and it'll basically make you have to do the calculation over again. And what they did with Willow is they demonstrated that they have a better approach to quantum error correction, and that I think they even used neural networks to optimize that, and which kind of makes sense because both are like kind of probabilities based.
So basically, I mean, this might be the totally wrong way to think about it, but some sort of concept of using like a neural network to probabilistically take noise out of the equation, kind of like a law of large numbers thing. It's like, okay, well, yeah, if, you know, if I invest in these 100 different things, of course there will be some that spike on the high end and spike on the low end. But if I invest in 100,000 of them, I might know almost exactly what the end result is going to be because I've leveled out my successes and losses through the law of large numbers, you know, like, so there's,
And
I assume some sort of model like that.
And what Google was able to do is they had basically one chip with 105 qubits, and they were able to demonstrate, I think, just one logical qubit out of those 105 qubits,
mm-hmm.
which physical qubits. And so with logical qubits, you're able to create a more reliable and useful quantum circuit. And so if it only takes 105 qubits to building block, this like fundamental building block,
an abstraction of qubits on top of an abstraction. Yeah.
It's almost like we went from like vacuum tubes to a transistor, but just one transistor. Mm-hmm. And so they showed us like what a quantum version of a transistor would be like and how you'd interact with it. If they can scale that up, which, you know, we've seen other companies like IBM scale their qubits up to thousands and at least many hundreds. And then you see, you know, like silicon can, you know, silicon chips, they can scale to many billions of transistors. So it's a possibility they might be able to scale this up, you know, within the next few years, maybe 5 years, I don't know. But there's also the concern of like, that's just what we know private industry is working on, like commercial industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like there's also defense contractors like Raytheon working on this problem as well. And I also know that InQtel has invested in a few different quantum computing companies. And so for those who don't know, InQtel is the private arm of the CIA.
I was about to say they fund CIA. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's definitely like some spooks who are looking into this problem as well and have been for a very long time. And so it's hard to know what they have. And there's the remote possibility that they already have that capability. So there's a spectrum of, you know, like how concerned we should be.
Mm-hmm.
And my default personally is that whatever time frame we have, ideally it's as long as possible, because there's still a lot of developments that need to happen in post-quantum cryptography for us to have like kind of like the optimal solution that's going to work for Bitcoin forever, right? Mm-hmm. And so ideally, qubit is just the starting place, right? Mm-hmm. And like, we'll evolve it, hopefully, over the next few years into something practical that can be put into practice and adopts, you know, more reliable forms of post-quantum cryptography things. And ideally, PQC goes through a lot more review than it already has been. And, you know, like any kind of libraries we come up with for the implementation of those PQC algorithms get a lot of eyes on it, especially because as we, you know, secure trillions of dollars worth of value, you know, mm-hmm. we need to be able to trust what we're like, maybe not trust, but have confidence in, right? Like the direction and like validity of these algorithms. And so that's one reason why I actually don't exclude SecP 256K1 signatures from the design of qubit. We actually call it hybrid cryptography. So it uses Bitcoin's current signature algorithm along with post-quantum cryptography. So it's I don't think we'll ever really replace classical cryptography, but I'm not sure
we might really need to be augmented, so to speak.
Exactly, with mm-hmm. the signatures that go into the attestation. And
this wouldn't change addresses at all, right? Because they're just hashes.
Well, so that is a good question. So the BIP360 is actually for a new, what they call output type, mm-hmm. which is like essentially an address. Like when it gets mm-hmm. encoded, it's when a script pub key like witness program is encoded, it's a... it looks like a, like when it's encoded in batch 32, it looks like, you know, BC1 and, for, native SegWit, it's BC1Q, for Taproot, it's BC1P, and for, Qubit, we're hoping to introduce, BC1R. And,
gotcha.
So
it would just be another iteration of a new quote-unquote witness type or address format, excuse me.
Exactly. Yeah,
address
exactly,
format.
Yeah. Exactly. And so, except they don't like me using the term address format for the BIP. I've gotten a number of people like, no, this is an output type. But nobody calls it an output type.
Shut up.
I mean, like only Bitcoin devs call it output type. You know, users call it an address. Yeah. And so that's one reason like I wanted to be able to make the BIP like easily understood by ordinary people, just plebs, you know, trying to like determine if you know, this is something they should consider, like worry about or think about. And you know, like that's the way that BIP was originally written was just to like address concerns and like, you know, we explain the motivation, rationale, that sort of thing. Hopefully we still did a decent job at it, but there was just so much feedback that like it's a completely different document than what we started off with. So to answer your question, like is it a hash of the public key? In many cases, but in Taproot, it's actually the public
key. It's the public key itself, yeah.
That's
a good point.
Yeah, which is not good. And that's an argument for maybe another BIP that I've had under consideration of writing. Ideally, I'm writing like one BIP at a time, but one of the BIPs I'm thinking of pushing forward, you know, as kind of maybe an alternative or intermediary between P2QRH, which is the address format that I'm introducing in for qubit, would be a P2 taproot hash. And so instead of quantum resistant hash, it's a taproot hash. And so it's basically like taproot, but just instead of having
just another layer of hash, so the public key is not visible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
Is there any, there's not even any reason why we couldn't have done that with Taproot from the get-go, right? Technically.
The consideration there was that it was kind of nice to be able to include just like a 32 bytes public key in the script hub key, and then you'd include the Schnorr signature in the witness, right? And that's 64 bytes. And so that's like, you know, a total of 48 weight or 48 V bytes, because you discount the signature in the witness, but you don't discount the X-only public key. And so that's 48 V bytes. And so, like that's pretty good. But like if you had to commit to a 32 bytes hash, you would need to also include the public key in the witness. And so that gets you...
Oh, your witness gets a lot... Your witness gets bigger because you have to...
Slightly bigger. So instead of being 48 V bytes, it's more like 64 V bytes. Mm-hmm. And that kind of cuts down on the narrative that Taproot...
Is more efficient. Is cheaper.
And so that might be one reason why they were like, we wanted the public key and the script hub key. But, and also being able to like disambiguate between, you know, a public key versus a public key hash is just, you know, you need to have probably a separate output type to like disambiguate. And so that's why, you know, it might make sense to just introduce
the hashed version
and
do another.
Yeah, exactly.
If you want to save in better money and you want 20,000 sats for free right now, it's about $20 at $100,000 of Bitcoin. Check out Fold. Every time I swipe this card, I get 0.5%, sometimes 1%, sometimes even 1.5%. I can get 2%, 3%, 5%, even 10% on gift cards with major merchants. Between the roundups, the gift cards, the auto stacking, the sats back on every single swipe, Fold literally does all of the work for me, and it is denominated in Bitcoin. And I have more savings just by using this card than like 90% of the United States normal consumer. I've got a referral link for you right here. Shout out to Fold for sponsoring my work and honestly being the most important service for my being on a Bitcoin standard.
I'm curious on, it's funny that you like mentioned that, you know, that could have been related to that Taproot thing, because I remember I've read conversations or whatever on the amount of arguments people have had about just like what to do with 20 extra bytes. It's like, how can we not put this burden on the network? And then the whole idea of qubits and or quantum cryptography or whatever is that the signatures are just massive. You know, it's just like not even 20 V bytes isn't even part of the conversation.
Right.
So what's, I mean, aside from, you know, the discount and making a new signature, is this something that you expect to change? And maybe if you know kind of the history of quantum resistant cryptography, has there been consistent advancements in more efficient quantum cryptography?
Absolutely. Yeah. So like kind of historically, we started off with Lamport signatures in 1977, and those are about 64 kilobytes in size. And that's just a signature. I think the public key is 16 kilobytes as well. So both those together. And like Adam Back is all like,
like 10 of those in a block, man.
And Adam Back's like whole like our answer to, you know, post-quantum cryptography is that like we can already do Lamport signatures in Bitcoin, and it just, you know, takes a lot of space. And so he was like, well, just add an extension block or something and have like, you know, those go there. And like that's similar to qubit, except qubit we want to like introduce new novel like cryptography that isn't just like 50 years old, you know. And like not saying that like a lot of people like Lamport signatures because they've had eyes on them for like 50 years
because they're 50 years old.
They're also enormous. And then there's also something called a Winternitz one-time signature, and that came out a little later, I think during the 80s, and That's much smaller, but it doesn't have as good security guarantees as like newer signature algorithms like XMSS. Both of those, I think, are hash-based. There's also lattice-based algorithms. Those are a bit more recent. There's one called NTRU or NTRU. And then Falcon builds on top of NTRU and makes signature sizes more like, let's see here. Let me just, I don't want to be inaccurate. So public key would be 1280 bytes, and a signature is 1793 bytes. So total of 3178 bytes, divide that by 16, you get a almost 200 V byte attestation, along with 140 V bytes for the other parts of the transaction. So that would be a total of 338 V bytes, and you could fit about 3,000 of those per block.
Yeah, is that the one with the highest computation cost?
It's with no, actually, Falcon's not so bad.
Okay,
yeah, the highest computational cost one, it's called SkiSign, which uses an even more novel form of cryptography called super singular elliptic curve isogeny, and what that does is it puts elliptic curves at higher dimensions, so more than just like an X and Y coordinate, but more like
X, Y, Z.
And so like the idea is to like make it much, much harder for quantum computers to solve that kind of problem. That's
yeah, put another exponent on it, basically.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so
I mean, is that generally the thinking behind quantum proof or quantum resistant cryptography? Is just like stick another layer of exponential on it, and is that really what it is, or is it like a fundamental change in the algorithm that just makes it the reversal harder in a different way?
Yeah, so not every algorithm, like for example, elliptic curve cryptography, if we were to just double how many bits there are in SecP, right? Instead of it being 256K1, it's like 512K1. Then that is only a little bit harder for a quantum computer to solve.
It's not exponentially harder for a quantum computer. It's just exponentially bigger for a conventional computer.
It's a very low polynomial number. It's like I generalize it in the bit, but I just say it's only maybe twice as hard. And so, but that's just like a generalization technically. But yeah, like just to put it in layman's terms, you know. But that said, like there are other problems that are higher dimensional that allow you to make it we believe just significantly more difficult for a quantum computer to solve. And like there's been a theory as to how they work, and it's actually put out in the Google white paper, is that they for Willow was basically quantum computers work in multiple dimensions, or multiple, how would you say, multiple universes, I should say, and like multiverse theory. And so like whenever you have like a certain problem space, what they call a Hilbert space, like it creates this like window into multiple universes and runs all those calculations in parallel. And then the wave function collapses into the single most likely state. And so if we're talking about multiple universes and then multiple dimensions, then maybe that's that's why those problems are so much harder for quantum computers to solve.
Interesting. Yeah, I had heard that. And I remember I was trying to trace that back, and I wish I had, you know, remembered or thought about that so I could have had that in front of me. But that was somebody basically posited that theory, I think it was like in the late 90s, if I'm not mistaken. And it's kind of like held on because there's still not like really a hard explanation as to why, you know?
Well, there's just so much we don't know. Yeah. like it's very humbling, actually, like when you look into like theoretical physics. And like, I don't know if you ever listened to Matthew Pines talk about theoretical physics, but
not at length, but I've been actually, you're the third person recently have been like, you should listen to more Matthew Pines on on some stuff like that. So
I love that guy.
I have to put that in my list. Actually, yeah. I should get Matthew on the show.
Yes, you totally should.
Yeah. That would be a fun rabbit hole.
Ask him about aliens. yeah, it's funny. The first podcast I ever saw with him on was like basically maybe right before the government had like this like panel with David Grush and a few other whistleblowers who are like, you know, testifying under oath that there are non-human intelligence from non-Earth origin. And I'm just like, the what? You know, like, and so then I realized that there's like this whole new rabbit hole that I've never gone through and never even considered. And like, they call it ufology. And I kind of consider it analogous to Bitcoin, or at least like Bitcoiners in terms of like the depth of the mythology and all that. In fact, it's even older, but like there's just so much depth to it. And one good primer for that is a book called In Plain Sight by Rouse Coulthard. And Matthew Pines also.
I'm actually just finishing up Turtles All the Way Down. So this will be a good one to add. What did you call it?
In plain sight. Yeah.
In Plain Sight.
Yeah. It's a good like kind of primer to the whole like rabbit hole, basically. Mm-hmm. And I've also gotten into like deep woo territory with
this is perfect. Aliens is perfect combo for quantum.
yeah. I saw this rabbit hole. I was just like, wow. There's another couple books by a professor of theology. Her name is Diana Walsh Pasulka, and she goes into like how UFOs may be technological angels and how angels might actually be a real thing, and how they might be involved in people's lives. And that's another, you know.
Dude, you know what rabbit hole that I went down? It was actually, I had started down it one day, and then it wasn't until years later I had watched The Mothman Prophecies, that movie, that kind of got me going back down that rabbit hole, and I kind of revisited it. But that whole thing, have you dug into that whole the concept of basically it's the idea of extra dimensional beings or whatever
what they call, kind like, of like through.
It's something like that. Yeah, there's a couple of different like framings for like how to imagine like what it is or what they are.
Yeah.
But the level of like coincidences and like people knowing things ahead of things actually happening. I mean, obviously, in retrospect, it's like one of those things that's like really easy to like, oh, I can identify this, this, and this. But some of them are very striking. And there's like hard evidence that, like, no, that is exactly what happened before this happened. If only they had put it on the blockchain and, you know, we could have timestamped it. But it was still really kind of crazy. There are some serious coincidences. And it also just kind of makes intuitive sense that, like, there would be the nature of some sort of a web or a network over another dimension, just because we see and witness them in all the others. You know, like why would our perspective be the last one? Like, it almost seems necessary that there would be another.
There's this guy, his name is, let's see, I'm trying to remember his name is, one moment. He was in the recent panel in, like on non-human intelligence. It was, he wrote a book recently, and, he was in like the military under like, just working for the Department of Defense on all kinds of weird stuff. And one thing he goes into is remote viewing and how it's helped him throughout his career. and something that he had been involved in early on during, I think during the 80s.
I feel like that went, something in that actually made the rounds recently. And I watched something about like remote viewing and stuff. And that's like one of those things, like there are so many, I try to find like some sort of intuitive explanation for some of these things, especially when somebody starts calling it angels or demons or whatever, because.
Well, they talk about like a thread that they pull on that they can kind of sense remote viewers, and they have like a protocol for like getting their head in that right, in the right like space to interpret what they're seeing. And you're actually not supposed to interpret what you see in the moment that you're observing. You're actually having to just like observe but not interpret, right? And because that just like breaks the link, and you're also not supposed to do anything evil with it. You're not supposed to do anything that's like morally just bad. And so like that's an interesting stipulation, right? That like, you know, there is the concept of evil and there's fundamental forces in the universe that like could be put like, you know, like make that value judgment, right? So that's interesting. Big if true, right? And you know,
well, I think in a natural sense you can think of good and evil is that which is in alignment with life and that which is not. And if there is some sort of underlying force, or and which may literally just be like another layer of something that tends toward inanimate physical world to organize into life, well, then it would also be something where there is clearly resistance if you are out of harmony with whatever that force is. Just like if you try to push on gravity, you know, you try to do the opposite, it's harder to do. And it, the idea of, you know, some sort of additional dimension, I guess, you know, people always think of different dimensions as like I'm transferring to another planet or something, you know, but I just conceptually, just from the simplest idea that there's another dimension of some sort of interaction that we just aren't aware of, which I feel like intuitively is always the case, you know, like, I mean, when was, go back 50 years and we found them, you know, like we, now we have new dimensions that we interact on and we can study and we can see that we didn't before, you know.
Yeah.
200 years ago, it might have made sense to think that, you know, while you're outside doing hard things or whatever, you pick up demons from the world. And if you rinse your hands off with water, the demons go away. And then, you know, 150 years later, you get a microscope and you've got all of this understanding. And like, sure, maybe it was true, but we found out, like, now we can just see the bacteria, you know, like there's
reality that we we weren't aware of because we didn't know how to look for it. And having that kind of like consciousness could be something that is like something that academia has difficulty exploring to begin with, you know? And so it's funny, there's a theory, and by the way, I remember the name of the author of the book. His name is Lou Elizondo.
Elizondo. L-U-E.
And there's also a theory by Roger Penrose, if you heard of Penrose. He's like this famous physicist from kind of like Feynman's era. And so, he came with like a bunch of black hole theories and stuff like that. And, which is like very novel physics and science, during, the 1970s. And we're only just now, like, you know, validating, those theories, using LIGO and these like laser interferometer gravity observatories. And so and I think they're about to put a satellite based version out in this space, and they call it LISA. But yeah, just being able to measure gravity waves and then like observe mergers of black holes from, you know, vast distances across space time, that is cool as heck. And then we just like validated all those theories about black holes. Like, we can observe them. And so
it all starts with imagination, man. You gotta be okay with sounding bonkers, or you're not on the edge of understanding, you know? Like, there's no forward progress without imagination first.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like expressing the idea that if matter is condensed too small of a volume, then it goes, like, if you push it past what's called the Schwarzschild radiance, then you know, like, it turns into a singularity, collapses, and it you know, becomes this like amazing mystical wild thing that, you know, like, if you had went back 100 years ago and explained to people, like, you know, maybe who are familiar with general relativity or special relativity, like, it might have raised some eyebrows. And so but Roger Penrose, he later worked on this theory called orchestrative objective redundance. And it's basically this, like, idea that, so there's this, like, bonkers hypothesis, and then there's this, like, way of validating this hypothesis that he came up with, because, like, he knew it was bonkers, and so we wouldn't, like,
don't trust verify.
We wouldn't validate. We couldn't, like, science couldn't validate it unless we had, like, this, like rigorous mental framework for, like, you know, figuring out if this hypothesis is true. And the hypothesis is basically that human consciousness is tied into quantum effects that are manifest in microtubules in the brain. You heard of this?
No, I don't know.
So,
this.
So, like, it's like,
it, like, sounds like something I would enjoy reading, though.
It's fascinating. Orchestrative objective redundance. And the first thing Wikipedia says about that is it is a highly controversial theory.
Orchestrative what? Redundance?
Objective redundance.
Objective redundance.
Reduction. Reduction.
Reduction. Reduction. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Orchestrated objective reduction, and
highly controversial sounds exactly like what I want to be reading about. So,
oh, it's fascinating. And so, like it, what's neat is that it theorizes that, like, there is a quantum basis for consciousness, and which might actually be something I've always wanted to ask Matthew Pines about. So please ask him about the quantum nature.
All right. I'll put that in the ask Matthew Pines about this.
Yeah. I would definitely watch that episode of TFDC. Like, the implication there is that there's entanglement occurring inside the brain, and there's a collapse of wave function. There's, like, there's also an implication there that having ungodly amounts of AI compute power is not enough to achieve artificial general intelligence. We may need to actually, like, accelerate this with quantum computers. And there are actually machine learning algorithms for quantum computers that run on them. And so it really is like one of those, like, optimization problems, like, through probabilities that quantum computers are capable of solving at much faster rate, and so than, like, kind of the classical processes. And so similarly with, like, you know, the human consciousness, like, the brain is already a very efficient computer, and one reason why it might be so efficient is because it has, like, this, like, wetware, like, quantum consciousness.
So the idea, let me see if I can wrap up some of this theory in a bow here, and how to connect quantum to this. So just the general idea of quantum is that, you know, the explanation that I've heard that has stuck with me, whether or not this is a proper mental picture of it, is that there is clearly with the computation, there is a clear path through all the different circuits and all the different, like, ones and zeros that take you from a private key to a public key.
Oh, the other way around.
No, I mean, just in general. When you're doing a computation, there is a certain elaborate path of things that take you from one to the other. And it's extremely difficult to go the opposite direction because you know the algorithm that pushes you to the public key.
Yeah.
But the public key is deterministic and not known ahead of time. So
The idea of a quantum computer is that if you can remove all of the noise, all of the heat, all of the general influence of it from the physical world, is that the last resistance will be between that public key and the private key, will just be the tendency for energy to flow from that public key back through the path to the private key. And so part of the idea is to remove all of the noise of the three-dimensional, the universe that we are in, so that just the energy itself can tell us what's the easiest path. Think about it, like water flows through the lowest path in a trough in a valley through the mountains, is that there is that, quote unquote, with energy passing through this huge, elaborate billion piece circuit, but there's too much noise. There's too much stuff in our universe or whatever, so to speak, that's making the energy want to do something different. So if we can remove all of that, it will just find the troughs in between all the mountains and the hills that will realign it and kind of reverse that. That is what I have heard about quantum, is that like, you set it in that space between zero and one and get rid of all of the other noise. The energy will tend toward one direction and it will fall zero or one a billion times, you know, to rebuild the circuit that takes us back to the private key. Is that a sensible picture to have for how that kind of works?
One part of it I'm not sure about is the energy part. Like the way I always imagine it is like a collapse of a wave function. So okay. you mentioned like the peaks and the valleys, right? But like there's like the probability that, you know, this might collapse into a one or zero is just like it's a compression of those possibilities. And so it becomes the most likely possibility that you get from that computation. And so that might be one way to conceptualize it. I also like think of it in terms of like Hilbert space, which is like the problem space that it needs to search through. And so you basically like by entangling all these qubits together, you enlarge the size of the problem you can solve. And so you're like maybe adding another universe to like being able to listen to another universe just through this one like fundamentally entangled in superconducting quantum computing, I think they call it they have Josephson junctions, and I think they call it a phonon. I could be wrong, but like there's like this like entangled phonons. I could be wrong though, but
I put that down on my list to dig into your phonons.
Yeah, like how do Josephson junctions work?
Josephson junctions. Okay.
Yeah. Those are like kind of like a fundamental part of superconducting quantum computing.
But how many logical qubits are necessary that you know of to basically put ECDSA at risk? So with Willow, it's 105 virtual qubits create one logical qubit, which is a huge step up from the previous needs of virtual qubits to make a logical qubit. How many logical, roughly, do you think or have you heard is it would take to risk elliptic curve?
For like RSA, I think the lower bound has to be 2n plus 1. Yeah. So basically, it would be like you need 256 qubits to contain the number, and then you need another 256 qubits to like work over the numbers, like kind of like working memory, and then you need like one control qubit. And so I think the minimum number is 513 logical qubits, and that would be like the very bare minimum. And then to do this efficiently, there are other ways that are even more efficient to do it and might actually be required for elliptic curve cryptography. And those have a lower bound of about 2,000 logical qubits.
Okay.
And so what's funny about that is just to put a bow on that, like, you know, it's just Shor's algorithm is actually like kind of a stone's throw where we are now in terms of quantum computing development. And in addition, it's one of the simpler things that a quantum computer can actually do is factor large numbers. And so one thing quantum computers can also do is simulate high energy physics, right? Like infusion reactors, or like model chemistry and optimize, you know, how we might develop pharmaceuticals. Well, all those applications require like many tens of millions of logical qubits. And whereas like Shor's is like 1,000, you know, like in the thousands.
Certain cryptographic algorithms will probably be the first things to reveal or to tackle, I guess, in a direct application of quantum computing.
Right. And one could, you know, if just like extrapolating further out, like maybe there's a possibility that like Satoshi's coins help accelerate the transition to quantum computing.
Because you basically got a bounty.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also the possibility that like one reason why we can't communicate with aliens is because like our protocols their protocols could be based on quantum computing. And there's also a something called the no communication theorem, which is like the idea that is that like quantum communication is impossible because it's not like, or at least like it's possible, but it doesn't go faster than the speed of light without like some kind of reference signal to send I think like some kind of matrix over. But the thing is, like, it's still vastly superior if you can, you know, communicate confidentially, potentially instantaneously. It's like without needing necessarily like a dedicated, you know, light speed like radio phenomenon. If that's possible, if it's possible to communicate using quantum computers, maybe like there is the no communication theorem. It's been discussed, but I'm not sure that we know everything about that. Like it's very possible that we just need better quantum computers in order to establish a quantum communication protocol. And the reason why I suspect that is because like even early radio communication required transistors to work, right? Like they needed like I think they called it a thyristor, like like basically a vacuum tube, but like it was needed to isolate the signal from the noise. Mm-hmm. And similarly, I think you might need a decent quantum computer in order to communicate. Kind of like how like our cell phones, they have like a cellular baseband like module that is basically a computer in its own right that, you know, is just dedicated to processing radio signals. And also, if you think about it, like if we were to develop such a technology that could transmit any distance practically instantaneously, then you wind up with a couple of interesting concepts. So like one is all radio communication from Earth would probably cease in like a decade as like everybody would transition to this vastly superior communications technology. And then we just kind of go radio silent because like it's just better, you know, and everybody transitions to it. There's that possibility.
And there's an interesting idea is that if we're thinking about intelligent life has already made this leap, is that the reason nobody's getting our radio signals is because for the same reason is you know, if somebody yelled on Jupiter, we wouldn't hear them, is because of like, nobody's listening for somebody yelling. You know, we're listening for cell signal and we're listening for, you know, like it depends on, it's so antiquated as far as like a mode of communication. And it's not even going to get to, if they're light years away. Okay, well then, yeah, it's going to take you 2,000 years for our message to even get there. So our entire span in which we are dumping all of these radio waves out into the universe is going to be tiny, could very well be this very tiny blip in the history of the species.
Yeah, could be a possibility.
Especially at the grand scale. Yeah,
could be a possibility. And yeah, I mean, maybe there are photons coming from other star systems that are entangled, and like the minute they hit our telescopes, they just completely, you know, like lose that entanglement, and that might be how you just kind of get the process started. So, you know, I have no idea if any of that is like, you know, the case, but it's just stuff I've kind of thought through that, like, oh, if that was true, then, you know, these other things could be true too. Another thing that like comes to mind is that there's a direct relationship between energy and information. And mm-hmm. if you're able to transmit information, you may also be able to transmit energy.
Yeah. That's interesting. Dude, there's the number of rabbit holes that as soon as you get into the realm of like, you don't even have a concrete explanation for it, which is what's interesting, both interesting and infuriating about the whole quantum conversation, is the difficulty in getting concrete stuff.
In one way, it's just a function of it being so new and also like theoretical and not applied in our everyday lives. And like, if you tried to go back 50 years ago and explain how a web browser works, right? Like they would have,
you'd have the same problem.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like, you know, maybe someday 50 years from now, we'll have very terse, succinct explanations for how all of these things work. And we're just like, right now we're just fumbling around, you know, trying our best to come up with explanations, but you know, once it becomes something that you can just teach in primary school, then, you know, it's reached the mainstream and we can talk about it with a measure of like, oh, well, you know, bacteria are, you know, like germ theory, right? Like mm-hmm. we have like, you know, and this is how it impacts our lives, and we have antibiotics and penicillin and stuff like
that. On that then, I feel like this is actually a good place to wrap it up. I don't want to take too much of your time. I know you're working on HSM stuff, but I'm curious. So what's your call to action for people, like for the audience? Is it to just start progressing this conversation or getting involved in the conversation?
I would say the best call to action I could give is, behind every piece of FUD is a kernel of like an actual concern, right? Mm-hmm. And like, I hate it when people dismiss FUD against Bitcoin instead of acknowledging it and then being like, yeah, but you know, it's not a concern because XYZ, right? For example, one thing people say about Bitcoin is that it's not backed by anything. And it's like, well, it doesn't need to be backed because it's sound money to have value, right? And like, mm-hmm. it doesn't need to be backed to have value. It's just sound money and it's scarce and it has good monetary properties and stable monetary properties, right? That can be dependent on in the long term. And also it's secured by energy from, you know, however many tens of millions of miners are out there. And in addition, there's like the fight around energy. So like there's like, okay, so, you know, we're going to start using 1% or 10% of the Earth's energy. I'm like, well, you know, like there's always that possibility, but that's not the case. And even if it was the case, it would be wasted, stranded energy that, you know, wouldn't have any better use anyway. And because like it's always...
But to just dismiss it as FUD is kind of like ignoring the point. It's just exactly. Like, well, no, there's a conversation about
there's
this.
There's a conversation to be had. Like, exactly.
Their framing is wrong, but I mean, it's an actual thing to have a conversation about. Yeah.
Exactly. And so for people who are like, you know, doing their best to FUD, like use that as an opportunity to like discuss like, well, Bitcoin is anti-fragile. It secures $2 trillion worth of value currently. And there's a huge monetary incentive to maintain that security. And there's a number of very intelligent people who are working on that problem of just making sure that Bitcoin is quantum resistant. And additionally, I would also say not to worry, because like 80% of coins out there are held in public key hash addresses, mm-hmm. or so. You know, it's not going to like be complete devastation to the network. There might be a period of time where there's like, you know, a transitionary period that could be quite, you know, stressful. But once that's done, then we've hardened Bitcoin, you know, for the foreseeable future. And that then addresses the concern, the valid concern that, you know, if we're having nation states start to stockpile these, you know, this coin, they need to have a safe place to put that coin. And for anybody who is in charge of large honeypot addresses, basically like exchange wallets or like mining pool rewards or just like the ETFs or, you know, wherever they're keeping their funds, right? Like, ideally, they don't reuse those addresses, meaning they can receive to the address multiple times. That's fine, so long as they haven't spent from it yet. Mm-hmm. And the moment you spent from an address, you've revealed your public key to the network. Yeah. And so that's
just deprecate it at that point. You just, right, like, this one's done. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And ideally, so we, like in these large custodians, they should move towards, you know, a BIP32 style higher HD wallet style key derivation, and keep your XPUB as private as your XPRIV, right? Mm-hmm. And so like at that point, like your keys need to be like both considered private and mm-hmm. and that's good for privacy anyway. So yeah, don't reveal your XPUB. Don't reuse addresses. Avoid Taproot addresses if you can. Native SegWit's fine. BC1Q is fine. Like if your address starts with BC1Q, that's fine. There's actually a table in the BIP where we show every address output type and
the relative risk.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah. So,
well, I have a link to all that stuff. I don't even put this in my list. Link to the BIP.
Yeah, BIP360.
Just so people can check it out.
Yeah, I'll link you to that too. There's 16, yeah, and I think that the TLDR is is just we're working on it, and please don't worry too much. In like, you know, even if there is Q day, it's not the end of the world. There will be a time to transition. We just need to be level-headed, think it through, and come up with the best possible solution at the time.
Yeah. And as I understand it right now, this will be a big breakthrough, which who knows what the timeline is on this, of a quantum computer that can generalize what computation it's doing.
Yeah.
So, because as far as I've read, and this was during the whole Willow rabbit hole, trying to make sense of that, is that they basically have to build the circuit. It's like a psychotically specific ASIC that, like, you have to build the entire thing to compute exactly what you want to compute. And so even when we get to the idea of the number of logical qubits that would be relevant, is that you have to or at least currently, without another breakthrough, which this would be a breakthrough to look out for in the quantum world, is that they would literally have to build their quote unquote quantum chip, whatever you want to call it, with the public key built in as the framework, like the physical framework for it, until we have a breakthrough that allows for generalization in it, as I understand it. So they would literally have to build a quantum computer starting from Satoshi's public key, which might actually fund it, you know, like when we get to that point or whatever. And then the only thing that it can actually crack is that one Satoshi public key.
That's not quite how I understand how quantum computers work. Like the qubits are programmable, right? So you can just reuse that circuit once it's.
How does the circuit work? Because that is, and this could be an extrapolation or implication from something that I read that was wrong, obviously. I understood that there was some sort of attachment to how they built it for, and this runs into a problem of not having a foundation for how the chips are even designed anyway.
But, so there are qubits and then there are gates, right? And mm-hmm. gates are like things like logical C not, you know, controlled mm-hmm. not. There's also something called a Hadamard gate, which basically sets the qubit as being an exact equal chance between settling as a one or a zero. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of like resets the state of a qubit, and then you can start like interacting with it. And so, if you chain, you know, controlled knot or CC knot or CCC knot, I think CCC knot is called Schiaffole gate. Like, if you're able to arrange these gates in a way that, like, you know, conforms to Shor's algorithm, which includes inverse quantum Fourier transform and modular exponentiation, then you may not need like additional gates for that. But like, mm-hmm. you know, on quantum computers, generally there's like thousands of gates for every, like, you know, 10 or 100 qubits.
Okay.
And they can be configured. Like, that's I think there's something like magic gate configuration code out there. So
it could very well be something that I read, either I misinterpreted it or they didn't know what they were talking about.
Yeah, there's actually a really great book called Quantum Computing for Everyone that is, I think it was published in 2017. It gives you kind of like a fundamentals first, like, kind of background on, it's basically the primer for quantum computing. So that's okay. Another rabbit hole.
Well, that's that's what we do here, is we go down rabbit holes. And, you know, fear, just generally speaking, fear comes from not knowing something, like not knowing how to respond to something, not knowing how to think about something, you know, not having even an idea of how this could attack you, or, you know, like, the fear is about the dark. Once you know what's in the dark and you know what to expect, you actually have a plan. You have a way to actually respond to what's out there. Exactly. And quantum computing right now is the dark for most people. And so, I don't know, don't be afraid of it. You know, don't just like sit around and be afraid, like just go get a flashlight. It's a book. Yeah, you know, like, go read a book. Like, that's what we do here. You explore it. We read about it. Everything's understandable. If somebody's building it, you can understand it. You just can. Well, like, there's nothing's off limits to anybody. Doesn't matter how abstract or woo-woo it sounds at the beginning. Most of it's just fucking jargon anyway. You know, like, it's understandable. It just is. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's well put.
I appreciate you coming on, man. And kind of going through this with me. I didn't know we were going to talk about aliens and demons, but that's pretty great, actually. And now I got to get Matthew Pines on, which he's going to want to talk about philosophy, and I'm going to ask him about freaking aliens. but this is a good one, man. Have we ever met in person? I feel like we have. Or have I just seen you?
Well, so, like, I'm a founding member of the space. If you have you heard of this space? It's like Denver's Bitcoin Citadel.
Yeah, Denver with Joey and yeah. like Wyatt and crew.
Yeah. So like I'm close to all those people, and Wyatt Rourke and Joyful Joey. They're all great.
Joyful Joey. Well, hell, regardless, next time we get to a conference at the same time together, we need to hang out.
Yeah.
Catch up, man.
Yeah, absolutely. It was nice chatting.
Yeah, man. Good time. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Later, boss.
Bye.
All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode. That was a really fun one. That went places that I wasn't expecting. And now I'm very intrigued, and I kind of feel like I need to get Matthew Pines on the show, and I've got a whole bunch of different rabbit holes to go down. So I have lots of links, and Hunter's going to send me an email with as many of the links as he remembers, and I'll try to get everything together so you have stuff in the show notes in the description so that you can check it out with me. I got another book to listen to, so tons to check out, bunch of great links. Don't forget to check out Fold. If you aren't stacking sats with them, then you really should be. And a great non-custodial or self-custodial wallet to use is BitKid. And I will have my ID, my key down in the bottom so that you can add me and check it out. All right. We'll wrap this up. A lot of good stuff coming, a lot of interviews lined up, and a lot of guys take in the lineup, and some really, really fun things happening on Paradrive. And I'm so happy to finally be able to share it with you guys. And I know I'm like holding back a little bit, and I haven't pushed it out there yet, even though it's working. But I want to feel comfortable with it. I want to know that it is working before I get other people to, I don't want them to be disappointed in it out the gate, even though it's limited. But when I feel like we are there, I will let you get your hands on it. So stay tuned. Links, details, all the good stuff. You know where to find it. And I am Guy Swan, and I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys.